Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nasir Arouri, author of Dishonest Broker, the U.S. Role in Palestine, who examines the reasons behind a succession of failed U.S.-led peace efforts over the past 35 years. Susan Schumann of the group Military Families Speak Out, who discusses her son's deployment to Iraq and the launch of a national campaign to bring U.S. troops home. And Lawson Legate of the Sierra Club, who discusses the record of Utah Republican Governor Mike Leavitt, whom President Bush has nominated to head the Environmental Protection Agency. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As Liberia's civil war escalated this summer, Donald Rumsfeld's Pentagon killed a report from its own team of specialists calling for U.S. military intervention to allow delivery of humanitarian aid. The team of military experts urged President George W. Bush to deploy 2,300 Marines to stabilize the situation and protect civilians from fighting between soldiers loyal to President Charles Taylor, who faces a war crimes indictment, and rebel troops. According to an account in the Los Angeles Times, the State Department welcomed the report's conclusions, but top Pentagon brass killed it, and it never made it to President Bush's desk. The Pentagon's European command told the team of military advisors to rewrite the report and to delete recommendations urging that U.S. troops be sent to Liberia. By the time 200 U.S. Marines arrived in the war-torn capital city of Monrovia in mid-August, more than 1,000 civilians in the city had been killed in the conflict. Thousands of people are also suffering from starvation and disease. In early August, the United Nations airlifted Nigerian peacekeepers into Liberia to stop the fighting and allowed the delivery of badly needed aid. A UN official observed, "That could have been American soldiers being cheered across Monrovia. This could have been an easy one for them." This past June, thousands of Iranian students engaged in nonviolent protests against government policies, including the country's plan to charge tuition for state-run universities. Larger issues of the reformist activist movement in Iran include the desire to reduce the power of the theocratic elite, the mullahs and their allies, and allow the elected government to rule. June's protest was met with harsh repression, with vigilante forces attacking the students, beating them with chains and batons, and the arrests of over 4,000. Another protest scheduled for July was thwarted when the Iranian government banned meetings, closed university dorms, and kidnapped three student leaders. Yet the global peace movement has been slow in responding to the concerns of Iran in dealing with its totalitarian government. Compounding matters, the Bush administration declared Iran part of the Axis of Evil following 9/11 and has hinted at its readiness to attack and occupy the country, even as Bush has publicly declared his support for the student protests. While some see the implicit threat on the part of Bush as one way to hasten reform, others say the mullahs are most likely to make concessions in oil and cooperation regarding Iraq while continuing their suppression of human rights. According to Jeremy Brecker, writing for the website Foreign Policy in Focus, support from the international peace movement for Iranians as the country faces greater pressure from the Bush administration has never been more necessary. Stuck in the slums of Istanbul, Turkey, Vladimir, an immigrant from Moldova, found a quick way to make money, to sell one of his kidneys for cash. Once his blood was tested and a recipient found, Vladimir gave up his best kidney for $3,000, minus the cost of travel, board, and expenses for the kidney broker. A few days later, the kidney was transplanted into an elderly patient who traveled from Israel. According to the New Internationalist magazine, the trade in human kidneys has become widespread in slums across the globe. The government in the Philippines has proposed creating its own organ bank to stop the illegal trade. It would allow for a poor person to sell and deposit a kidney into a virtual organ bank that is open to anyone who needs it. But the value of a human kidney is still a murky question. The director of the Capital Hospital in Manila says some desperate people sell a kidney for a bag of rice. Others will exchange an organ for the promise of free medical care for their children. For the last 5 years, Iran's government has run an organ bank. The donors are recruited directly from the slums or among the homeless by a nonprofit self-help medical organization. The donors are paid a flat fee, nearly $280. Yet there are reports that kidney sellers are in significant pain and suffer later from anger and resentment against doctors who do the transplants. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Britta Brundage. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
Since the 1967 Israeli invasion and occupation of Palestinian territory, the United States government has assumed the role of chief arbiter in the region. However, during the past 35 years, six U.S. administrations have opposed a settlement that would have put an end to the Israeli occupation and the establishment of a Palestinian state existing side by side with Israel. The relationship between Israel and the United States developed into a strategic alliance, with the U.S. becoming the nation's chief supplier of arms, diplomatic backer, and financial donor, shielding Israel from international criticism. This ultimately placed the U.S. at odds with a global consensus in support of a political settlement within an international framework. Despite numerous initiatives symbolizing diplomatic achievements, none have yet brought stability or peace to the region. President Bush's initiative, called the Roadmap to Peace, promised to resuscitate the peace process in three stages, but fails to reveal any real timeline, nor enforcement or monitoring mechanisms. And with the latest Palestinian suicide bombing in Jerusalem, August 19th, killing 18 Israelis, hope for the roadmap is fading. Nasir Arouri is the author of Dishonest Broker, The U.S. Role in Israel and Palestine. He spoke with your reporter Denise Manzari about the role of the United States in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and why he feels it has thus far failed to achieve peace.
Arafat in 1993 and Abbas in 2003 are accepting the American premise rather than the traditional Palestinian premise that was supported by an Arab consensus and indeed by a global consensus for more than two decades.
The speech by George W. Bush, delivered June 24th, 2002, basically did away with the whole Clinton-era approach. Some said it could have been written by Ariel Sharon. Since September 11th, obviously, this has turned around the whole administration and how it addresses the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Even more than before, Israel is looked at as a victim and the Palestinians as terrorists. Do you want to talk a little bit, Nasir Arouri, about that speech delivered by George W. Bush?
Sure. In this speech, the whole Palestine question seemed to have undergone a transformation in American foreign policy, a transformation from the cause of a people dispossessed, disenfranchised, then whatever was left of their land after 1948 was occupied in 1967, and with all these settlements that are built in it, it's becoming difficult really to have a Palestinian state. We find now it has been transformed into an issue of terrorism. I mean, occupation was abnormal. Occupation, as far as the global consensus, was to come to an end by virtue of Resolution 242. And the Palestinians would establish a state alongside Israel, and they live in peace. Now, I think we have a different formulation, which even Abbas accepted. The new formulation is that occupation is not that abnormal. What is abnormal is resistance, and therefore the Palestinians would have to stop resistance. And resistance is being subsumed under Bush's favorite rubric, terrorism. And this term, of course, gains currency in the aftermath of September 11th. I think this is the assumption in the speech of the 24th. And this is also an assumption in the roadmap, particularly phase one of the roadmap, which places requirements on the Palestinians to stop terror and violence, i.e. to end the Intifada, to end all forms of resistance.
In getting back to the roadmap, as it's called, roadmap of peace, although George Bush did not offer anything in the way of a peace process during that speech, there's a short title in your book called A Shortcut to Baghdad, Bush's Roadmap.
Do you want to talk about the relationship of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict to Baghdad and the invasion of Iraq?
I wish I had been able to update the book, but of course that was impossible. But I think when you really look through it and analyze it, and I did my own analysis, and I find that the gridlock is in it, the vague categories are in it, and what's in it also is a high threshold of requirements that are being placed on the Palestinians. What does that mean? It means that either Bush or Sharon could easily bet on the failure of Abbas, because after all the requirements are high. Someone like him without the legitimacy of Arafat may not be able to perform, and this is a performance-based agreement that could end up with Sharon just delaying, and that's a tactic that he excels in. By the time elections come in the United States, then all attention is focused on that. And the Israelis will have a very marvelous cover again to go on. I mean, this has really been Israeli strategy. It is to delay and delay while trying to create more fait accomplis and more facts on the ground.
Do you think a secular binationalism is feasible, and will they ever see peace?
The only alternative, really, to apartheid is going to be a single state where the Muslims, Christians, and Jews would live on the basis of equality. I mean, something like the 14th Amendment, no unreasonable classifications in the law. And secondly, one can also argue that the lives of the Palestinians and the Israelis are intertwined in terms of foreign policy, in terms of resources, in terms of the environment. But is this going to come tomorrow? Is it going to come in 10 years from now? I doubt it very much. Is it going to come in 50 years from now? I don't know. I hope so.
That was Nasir Arouri, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, and author of Dishonest Broker, The U.S. Role in Israel and Palestine, published by South End Press. For more information, visit the website www.southendpress.org. Even as President Bush and Paul Bremer, the U.S. administrator in Baghdad, talk optimistically about the progress being made in stabilizing Iraq, new guerrilla attacks on American forces and other targets there have escalated. A truck bomb driven into Baghdad's Canal Hotel on August 19th destroyed the United Nations headquarters, killing the top U.N. diplomat in Iraq. Another truck bomb destroyed the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad earlier in the month. These attacks, along with a string of other assaults on Iraq's oil, water, and electric power infrastructure, point to a new pattern of economic sabotage and strikes at civilian targets. Meanwhile, guerrilla forces, thought to be remnants of Saddam Hussein's regime or Islamic nationalists, continue to attack U.S. troops, with the death toll recently exceeding 260 killed since President Bush ordered the invasion of Iraq on March 20th. The deepening conflict has also claimed the lives of increasing numbers of Iraqi civilians and other non-combatants. An award-winning cameraman for Reuters, Mazen Dana, was shot and killed by U.S. troops August 18th in what the Pentagon described as, quote, another tragic incident. With the danger growing for U.S. troops in Iraq, some family members of military personnel stationed there have begun publicly calling for an end to the occupation and a speedy return of American forces. Susan Schumann of the group Military Families Speak Out has a son in the Massachusetts National Guard deployed in northern Iraq. She recently helped launch a national campaign with a coalition of veterans and peace groups called Bring Them Home Now. She spoke with Between the Lines' Scott Harris about the goals of the campaign and the hardships and demoralization she believes are plaguing American troops serving in Iraq.
My son is a Massachusetts National Guardsman, so he's not regular Army, and he's stationed in Samarra in northern Iraq. And unfortunately, I haven't heard from him for about 2.5 weeks. Communication is really difficult, which is hard for me. In our last conversation, one of the things he said to me was that the United States just doesn't understand what's going on here. He said there are 30 to 40 major incidents a day. His office took a direct mortar attack. living conditions are very difficult. He doesn't complain about that at all. Obviously, as his mom, I'm very concerned about that. He's lost 30 pounds. They're rationed to 2 liters of water a day. It's 120 degrees, so 2 liters of water is a pretty skimpy ration. I think what is of greatest concern, however, is that where he is stationed, they are under constant ambush. There are ambushes all of the time. They're engaged in a guerrilla warfare on a daily basis. And, of course, he's in a National Guard unit. These guys and gals are all signed up and are perfectly willing to do the job. But they find themselves in a situation where there wasn't what they bargained for. I think even more seriously, some of the things that I'm hearing from him and from other people in his unit is that they don't have equipment. They don't have supplies. They don't have the kind of support that they need to be able to do the job. One of the things he said to me is they don't even have radio. So people go out and patrol and they can't radio back. I think it's a very poignant description of the cynicism of the Bush administration and Rumsfeld, and that the way they have approached the aftermath of the supposed shock and awe bombing with absolutely no planning. Essentially, there was no preparation for the follow-up of the bombing of the country of Iraq.
Tell us a little bit about what's behind the campaign of Bring Them Home Now, the groups that are involved in it, and what the immediate goals are.
Bring Them Home Now is a campaign that has been started by Military Families Speak Out, in conjunction with a number of veterans organizations, Veterans for Peace, and other organizations that concern military personnel. And the campaign is pretty simple. It's just common sense. Our troops want to come home. Their families want them home. The people of Iraq want them to go home. So we need to bring them home. The presence, the military presence in Iraq, the presence of U.S. military personnel in Iraq, is not really solving any kind of problem whatsoever. As long as there are troops in Iraq, the Iraqi people are going to resist them. They are also proud people. As long as there is a military presence in Iraq, we're not going to solve the problem of this continual daily insurgency and resistance. It's not going to make it any safer. We're not going to pacify the Iraqi people. We've got to bring the troops home and then move into the reconstruction of and the healing of this shattered nation. We have to undertake a political process that will rebuild the Iraqi nation. Of course, Bush and Rumsfeld aren't the slightest bit interested in doing that. Bush and Rumsfeld are interested in guarding their oil reserves and guarding their oil interests and an empire building.
The Bush administration, of course, says that U.S. troops have to remain to keep things stable in Iraq so the people of that country can build their own democracy and to prevent remnants of the old regime, Saddam Hussein's regime, from coming back in power and terrorizing the Iraqi people another round. How do you respond to that whole idea that U.S. troops must remain in Iraq to create stability and help the Iraqi people?
The American troops, they are being misused as an occupying force, as police, a job they're not trained for, they're not prepared to do. Iraq clearly needs policing to prevent the kind of anarchy that's making the Iraqi people suffer as well as the American troops. But that is not the role of the American military. We need to get in an international police force. We need to deal with the political issues in Iraq of dealing with the Ba'athist Party and the remnants of the Ba'athist Party requires a political solution. These things are not the job of an occupying military force which is perceived as hostile by the Iraqi people. I mean, all of the justification in the lead-up to the war, none of that has been proven true. Our troops are there illegally and completely unjustified. There was no threat to the people of the United States. There were no weapons of mass destruction, no nuclear program, no chemical or biological shells ready to fire at 45 minutes notice, and no ties with Al-Qaeda.
That was Susan Schumann with Military Families Speak Out and the Bring Them Home Now campaign. Visit the group's websites at www.mfso.org or www.bringthemhomenow.org. Recent public opinion polls have revealed that a majority of Americans are unhappy with the way the Bush administration is handling the nation's environment. From oil and gas extraction on public lands to preservation of endangered salmon in western rivers to arsenic in drinking water and mercury in the air, many people feel environmental protection in the United States has become an oxymoron. Bush's director of the Environmental Protection Agency, Christy Todd Whitman, resigned this summer after 2.5 years of losing most battles to two of the most powerful oil men in the country, President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. On August 12th, President Bush nominated three-term Republican Governor Mike Leavitt of Utah to replace Whitman at the EPA. Bush praised Leavitt as a consensus builder and pointed to his bipartisan work to improve air quality in the Grand Canyon. Like Bush, Leavitt wants to shift pollution control from the federal government to the states, and he favors voluntary environmental compliance over mandatory regulation. Industry leaders are pleased with Bush's choice, while environmental advocates are not. They say Leavitt has a weak record on protecting Utah's land, water, and air, and fear he will further undermine federal environmental protections. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Lawson Legate, a senior Sierra Club staffer in Utah, about Leavitt's environmental record and what might be expected of Leavitt if he wins Senate confirmation to the EPA post.
Our disappointment with the governor has to do largely with his claim to be a consensus builder and someone who believes in, as he would put it, collaboration and not polarization. And I hate to say this about Governor Leavitt, but he actually is a kind of person who believes more in command and control. In other words, we hear about decisions after they are made, despite our attempts to participate. The governor talks a lot about how he likes to include the interested parties in decision-making, but we tend to find out about the decisions after he's made them behind closed doors. And that's very disappointing. And I think that it's important for people to know that despite the talk about the governor's alleged moderation, that he, in fact, is a very charming person in person. He's very skillful at using his personal charm, I think, to mask, on the environmental front at least, a more extreme agenda.
Has he done anything that environmentalists support?
The one area in which Governor Leavitt, along with most every other politician in the state, sees eye to eye with environmental organizations is that we all oppose plans to store nuclear waste at an above-ground site about 45 miles west of Salt Lake City. It's the proposed Skull Valley site on the Goshute Indian Reservation. All too often, Utah is viewed by some as apparently as a sort of dumping ground for the nation's toxic and nuclear waste. That's a very unpopular proposal in the state, and the governor is certainly on the right side on that issue.
There have been many attempts by Republican governors in the West, Western states, to overrule federal environmental policies or to try to get them changed, especially land use policies, since the feds control a huge percentage of public lands in the West. What can you tell us about Mike Leavitt's role on this issue?
Well, in particular, there really were two decisions made back-to-back by the governor along with the Bush administration that are very hostile to the idea of protecting public lands that are owned by all Americans that are in Utah. One of them, the governor struck a deal behind closed doors with the Interior Department, part of the Bush administration, which would forbid any further planning on the part of the Federal Bureau of Land Management to protect its wildlands and to study its wildlands for future inclusion in the National Wilderness Preservation System. That was going along quite quite well until suddenly Governor Leavitt concluded this deal with the Bush administration and Secretary of the Interior Gail Norton to stop any further wilderness studies. It was a very hostile move. As you may know and your listeners may understand, that one of the great unfinished agenda items for the nation is the protection of our remaining wildlands in the state. We haven't protected at all yet. There's still millions of acres of land in Utah and across the West that deserve to be protected as wilderness. We haven't finished that job yet, and it looks like the governor does not intend to be a productive partner in that effort. I regret to say, and this is not a compliment, that he will be a good fit with the Bush administration. I think a recent poll indicates that Americans, by a margin of 2-1, actually trust the Democratic Party more than the Republicans to take action to protect the nation's environment. And so I think it's probably no surprise to people that this is a presidential administration that arguably has the worst environmental record of any administration in history. And Governor Leavitt is going to join that team, not to rock the boat, but I'm sorry to say, to help implement policies that are damaging to our environment.
The main reason, at least as it has been reported, the main thing that Bush points to in picking Leavitt was this whole consensus agreement around cleaning up the air around the Grand Canyon. Do you think that his effort in the Grand Canyon bore fruit at all?
That's way too soon to tell. I mean, the bottom line is that the Grand Canyon air quality there, which, by the way, comes into southern Utah frequently, isn't yet cleaned up. First of all, his primary approach to this sort of thing is to ask the polluters to voluntarily clean up. Well, that has its place. At the end of the day, when folks haven't complied, then you need to have the hammer of regulation, which says, you know, whether you like it or not, you're going to have to clean up. This is a governor who is very supportive of coal, the use of coal for generating power, because, of course, Utah is a coal-producing state. And yet we know that coal is one of the fundamental sources of that haze over the Grand Canyon in southern Utah, and it is one of the primary sources of global warming gases.
That was Lawson Legate of the Sierra Club's Utah chapter. For more information on why the Sierra Club opposes Leavitt's nomination, call area code 415-977-5500 or visit the group's website at www.sierraclub.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Bill Cosentino, Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.